be is I'm supposed to tell you you're breaking in a new partner in on this.
Partner again?
Yeah, some cat he's on loan from Dope. Real burnout, on the ragged edge.
Oh, perfect.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, Lethal Weapon Retrospective Series.
How are you, boys?
Join Garrett.
I suppose we have to register you as a lethal weapon.
Matt.
I'm surprised you haven't heard about me. You know, I got a bad reputation, and sometimes I just go nuts like now.
And Adam.
You're my family and my friends.
As they review all four films in the seminal Richard Donner-directed action franchise starring Mel Gibson and Danny Glover.
I'm warning you.
Will Adam be able to recover after reviewing the entire Children of the Corn series?
God hates me, that's what it is.
Hate him back, it works for me.
Why did Matt want to do this series so bad?
You really are crazy.
And will Garrett still adore these films now, just as much as he did in his teens?
Come on, be original. Say yes, everyone else says no. Come on with me.
Find out the answers to these questions, as well as many more.
Do you really want to jump? Do you want to?
Coming up next, courtesy of Percolated Media.
Well, we go on three.
Three on three.
Okay, one, two, and like
three.
Yeah? Okay. On three.
Three.
One.
Two. Three!
Lethal Weapon 3, released May 15th, 1992. Budget on this was $35 million. Box office, $321.7 million. And this was directed by Richard Donner. Guys, they were so successful in 1989. Here we are in 1992. I am joined by my two jams and my jelly roll, Adam and Matt. We are here to discuss Lethal Weapon 3. Adam, last week you said this was a theatrical experience. How excited were you in 1992 for Lethal Weapon 3?
Quite a bit. The other movies were fun. They were big, bombastic. They were like the action buddy standard that stuff was going for that round. And this one, I thought the trailers, you got to look at the age that I was in 1992. I mean, this was big bang, shoot 'em up, explosions, good music, good trailer. And I was like, yeah, dad's going to take me to see this. Let's go. Couldn't wait.
Ah, so Pops took you to this, huh?
Absolutely.
Matt, what about you, sir? You're going through your marathon. You said you watched these within the span of a couple of days. Did you wait a day after two to put this on, or did you put it on like immediately after?
Not immediate. It's very rare that I will do back-to-back viewings unless it's something I am either head over heels about with the franchise in totality, or there's a cliffhanger that is like a direct lead-in that makes me want to watch it more. This one, not so much. I kind of, I don't want to say trepidation is the right word, but, you know, three is the magic number for a lot of these. It can be the cliff starting to slant down, or it could be the opposite, where some of these actually get better from three on. I mean, those are more uncommon, but it's not out of the question. And I was curious to see. One thing about those first two movies, they are very steeped in the 80s in multiple ways, even though they're in the back half of that decade. This one, we got a new decade, new sensibilities, new fashion, new, certainly, filmmaking techniques in the 90s. I was curious to see if this could make the transition, because not every franchise was able to do that.
No, it wasn't. And this one had a hard time making a transition from page to screen. This script was rewritten 40 times. It was worked on by Jeffrey Boehm once again, and he had brought on his buddy Robert Mark Kamen. Now, Robert Mark Kamen is a name that is familiar to people who are fans of The Karate Kid, as I am. He was the brainchild behind those, and here he is working on this, and apparently he had worked on number two as well, but this time he gets a screen credit. Boehm wrote the first script by himself. What he wrote that about was neo-Nazis, and the studio didn't really like that, so he brought on Robert Mark Kamen, who did some work on it, and the studio really didn't like that. And like I said, this thing was written 40 times. At one point, Carrie Fisher was brought in. She kind of did some work on the script as well. She did work on the dialogue, and she did a lot of work on Rene Russo's character. You know, guys, without getting into our thoughts, boy, this does have the feel of a script that was written 40 times.
Not just that, we have to go back to the source. This is the first one that Shane Black has no involvement in whatsoever, outside of just originating these characters. And you can really feel his absence in this compared to the first two, not just on a quality level, certainly from my perspective, but just the writing in general feels very different stylistically. But I'll give the movie this. The fact that this movie made more money than Batman Returns is kind of shocking in hindsight when you look at how big Batman 89 was and that outgrossed Lethal Weapon 2. I think the only sequel this we lost to was Home Alone 2, and I think that's just because of cross-age appeal. But you know who really was happy about this year? Joe Pesci's accountant.
Yeah, because at this point, Joe Pesci was an Oscar winner. And, you know, you would have thought that he would have been the one who was like, you know what, I had fun in 1989, but I don't need this anymore. But here he is. He's the one who came up with the idea of platinum hair. He's the one who came up with the earring. He's here, and boy, oh boy. I cannot believe they got the gang back together for this.
Especially because it's got swings in tone, swings in just styles, and characters that are in here don't really seem to have a reason. From time to time, yeah, this thing is, it had broad strokes that stayed through, but other than that, oof, yeah, this is doctored more than freaking Joe Pesci's plastic surgery around this time. I mean, this thing is, it's all over the place.
The first two Lethal Weapons, Ebert gave pretty high marks to. In fact, he was huge fans of both those films. This is the first one where he wasn't too high on it. He still gave it a thumbs up, but he was like, I don't know about this. This was a one that when it was released in theaters, I didn't watch, not for any other reason other than I was probably grounded or something going on where I couldn't get to the theater to see it. But the first week it was on video, I was there. I brought it home the first week it was at Blockbuster Video. So we start off with this slow jazz opener sung by Sting as fire just kind of takes over the screen. Guys, we made this comparison a couple times since we started this show, and I feel the need to make it again. This is the beginning of Batman 89 again, isn't it?
It is, but also it just goes to show that the 90s was the heyday for getting musicians to do the theme songs for movies that really don't match the style of the music. Because you have this, you have the Seal song for Batman Forever. I know it wasn't written for that movie, but that's what gave it the carte blanche. And Sting had done, a couple of movies before this, but this was the start of him doing, like, Demolition Man. The Three Musketeers took that literally because they got him, Bryan Adams, and Rod Stewart to do the song.
Yes. Yep.
They looked at Prince of Thieves and went, oh, you only got one pop star Corona love ballad. We're going to get three of them.
You always bring up that movie, and I've still never seen that Three Musketeers film.
I think you would really. It's a lot of fun.
That's what I heard.
And I have a similar comparison as we get into the movie, not just because of the number that is shared in both titles.
The Batman comparison is an apt one, so spot on. But I fucking love this opening. And you know why? Because I loved Sting around this time. He was cool. The music part, yeah, you know why? Because you used to have this television station that would play music videos, Google it, kids, and it was like a channel, all of a YouTube channel that played nothing but music videos, and every single music video for a movie, it was just a commercial. So even if it didn't fit, Kiss from a Rose was a great example. It was a commercial for the film, and you play it several times a day. This one here is a commercial for the film. I don't know if I will ever be able to hear You Can Be Mine by Guns N' Roses without thinking of Terminator 2. Well, some things just stick. But this one, I forgot how much I really like this song. And the intro, yeah, it's just fire. You might as well have a Mission Impossible intro, the way this fire is just kind of wiping around the screen. But I think it's a great start. It's different. I love the jazz beat to start it off. And then it lures you into a false sense of security. And I think that's not a bad choice.
Garrett, you know what? Adam Link's Sting in 1992 because he hadn't put on the face paint yet.
God from damn it. You took my next line. Fuck you.
You know what? That is true.
1992, though.
Joe Pesci got the blonde hair from, too.
Yeah, maybe.
Oh my God.
1992, though, this was past Sting's prime. I hate this song. I don't like these opening credits. To Matt's point, it doesn't fit the movie that we're about ready to see here. Even Demolition Man fit that movie, for Christ's sake. This is just, we're setting a way different tone than we had before. Right the fuck away, even before we get to the very first scene of this film, it's different.
Yeah, I mean, they got him and Elton John to do songs on this. You couldn't just pick one?
Yeah. So after these credits, we see our heroes, Riggs and Murtaugh. They pull up to a building that has a bomb in it. They argue over whether to wait for the bomb squad to take care of it or to do it themselves. This is where we hear that Murtaugh has 8 days until retirement. And one thing I noticed in this one, boys, more than any other movie so far in this franchise, man, they go for the sax punchlines hard in this one.
Well, it's not just the punchlines. A lot of the things in this movie are reduced to singular gags. This reminds me, and it's sort of a precursor to what I will call the Marvel problem, where it's, I don't have a problem with jokes, because human beings tell jokes. I have a problem with gags. It's when we stop a scene for someone to say something that they would not say, and they keep hammering it. And with these two guys, their banter is just, I'm old and you're crazy. The scene later on when they're running from the fire and the bomb goes off, there should have been a freeze frame of them jumping with sitcom credits, because that's what this one really feels reduced to. We're starting to get closer to like formulaic sitcom storytelling.
Yeah, even the last one, even as farcical as that one was, and it definitely had jokes and things in it, but it still had an edge to it. I don't think this one has an edge as we get into it.
Well, it's got an edge, but those parts feel really out of place.
Oh, God. Oh, yeah, sir.
Funny, I was struck with the opening credits as they were going through. You know what I realized? You know who the DP is of this film? Did you guys catch it?
Yep, it's the director of Speed 2. Yep.
Yes, Jan de Bont, which I'm like, I kind of feel like he's writing and directing this movie, not just shooting it. Okay, I like some of the banter here at the beginning, because I get these two back together, and I'm happy to see these two on screen. Here in this scene, it doesn't grate on me. To Matt's point, though, I'm realizing that it's feeling very slapsticky, and it is feeling very sitcom, and I don't think it wears well throughout the course of the film. But here, getting it back together, because this scene, I think I mentioned it in our last one, this scene was shown on, I think, Entertainment Tonight. You know, oh, you're going to watch them really blow up a building. You know, that was a big deal before Chris Nolan was doing that kind of stuff. So I was happy to see this. I like the joke with the cat and the red wire, blue wire. But I'm noticing immediately that it's joke forward. It's not character and action forward. And I think that's a big change, and I don't think it's for the better.
Even that note of the red wire, blue wire, that feels too much like a simplification of these two guys. And in a lot of ways, I feel like these characters get dumber with each subsequent movie. They don't feel like the rank that they should be, as experienced as they are. And it's to the point where it's like, okay, if they're this reckless when it comes to a bomb situation, which borders on terrorism, they would have been demoted well before this instance. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's coincidence that they got Jan de Bont, because the opening of this movie, of a high-rise building that could be blown into oblivion, that's right out of Die Hard, and he was the DP on Die Hard.
We'll be talking about him again when we get to Cujo as well.
That's the thing about de Bont in general. I would compare him to great offensive coordinators who shouldn't become head coaches.
Or defensive coordinators.
his DP work, a lot of it's great. I mean, Die Hard, we'll talk about Cujo, we'll talk about plenty of other ones he's done. But then when you look at his directing resume, his rookie year was great, and then I don't know what happened, because I can't believe the guy who made Speed also made Speed 2.
I can't believe the guy who made Speed made Twister, for God's sake. Maybe we'll get to those movies eventually. So Riggs and Murtaugh, they start looking for the bomb in the parking garage, and it sure doesn't take long for Riggs to spot it in a car. They avoid a catastrophe, as Riggs can't remember which wire he said he was going to cut. He asks Roger if he's going to miss this stuff when he retires, and he does indeed cut the wrong wire. They grab the cat, and you know what? This building blows up real good, doesn't it? Joel Silver, he asked the studio for $500,000, because they were going to blow this building anyway, but the fact that he got the permit to do it, here we are. They get out, and the building blows up, and we have a huge explosion to start things off.
Yeah, building blow up real good. It does its job that way. You got to realize, 32, 33 years ago, you didn't see stuff like this practical, and this is a real building. It's not a miniature. It's not a model. It looks fucking great.
No, it took the Dark Knight for someone to do something like this again, practically.
And one thing I've learned, boys, in the last few years, cats are not this calm in the arms of people. Here's where Murtaugh holding this cat, and it's not moving.
Look, this movie's got so many yucks, the cat might as well have driven the car. watched.
Rick says, oops, and they argue which wire he cut, and is it just me, or do you guys get the feeling that Riggs cut the wrong wire on purpose so that Murtaugh could see what he's going to be missing when he retires?
Never crossed my mind, but now it makes sense. This one does go full-blown Three Stooges.
Oh, good call. So
there's a set piece later on that would make Mo, Larry, and Howard blush.
So we see the guys as street cops as punishment, and they just fuck around with this guy as he's jaywalking, which, goddamn. All right. I know this is punishment for them, I guess, but here they are fucking with this guy. They should get punished for this as well. This is just bad.
Well, the first 30 minutes of this movie, or up until the quote-unquote plot actually gets going, like, these all feel like scenes you would watch in a sitcom where there's no forward momentum. They're all compartmentalized. The only reason why it's actually somewhat connected is because of the, as coincidental as it is, the armored car being robbed. Like, if this guy wasn't jaywalking, the plot of this movie wouldn't have happened.
That is one thing I've noticed with this one as well, Matt, as I was watching it for this podcast. These guys aren't detecting anything. Everything that happens in this movie, everything they find, is all coincidental. They just happen to be there.
Yeah, everything happens to them, not because of them.
Yeah.
It's true. You know, when I was 13 years old, I was having a good time and laughing with it. Now that I'm older, I realized why my dad would enjoy the first two more, and this one was the letdown, and I can see why Siskel and Ebert would consider this a step down. I don't want to say it's stupid, you know, that's a little insulting, but to Matt's point at the very beginning, you could tell that Shane Black had nothing to do with this, and that so many hands reached into the cookie jar that it's so inconsistent, and it doesn't know what it wants to be.
Well, I think this movie has the problem of, because this plot is so thin as being kind, it's borderline anorexic. I get the sense they feel like they had to compensate by making this much more of a comedy to fill time so that the audience laughter can add about 5 seconds to each scene.
So they see an armored car get taken over as Riggs gets inside and Roger gets cozy with the woman whose line I used earlier in the podcast, and he tries chasing Riggs down. Again, great stunts, but this action scene is just bogged down by too many yucks.
I now know how you guys felt with the Sergeant Pepper in Live and Let Die / Man. Because that's what this woman is to me, where this feels right out of The Naked Gun, not Lethal Weapon, which the first two movies, the second one gets more absurd, but I always felt like those were real people. In this one, a lot of the side characters are really overly exaggerated, and we're starting to see also, this is the sponge of franchises, because they can't just leave shit on the counter. They have to suck it up and bring it back, which makes it worse in retrospect. And I really think it undermines the stunt work, because all the impressive stuff is there, but it's being underserved by going for one too many laughs. It's almost at the expense of the action.
Meanwhile, Riggs is knocked outside the window, and then he pulls himself up to the driver's seat. He slams on the brakes as the guy is pulled through the window, and Riggs reads him his rights. We cut to Roger's house. Haven't been here in a while. Riggs kisses everybody, including Roger, hello, as Leo pulls up. Now, again, Pesci, fresh off his Oscar win, which means he got to choose his hair color for this film, as well as his earring that he wears. He shows a couple the house, I guess they're going to be selling it, and brings up how a car was driven through it, so we're getting that plot point mentioned again. And Riggs takes up eating dog biscuits. Which is weird, Matt, because last year we covered Mad Max, where he was eating dog food in that one as well.
Yep. Okay, so let's address the Pesci in the room. There is no good reason to bring him back.
No.
He feels so tacked on that I might as well put him on the refrigerator, and he would probably fit. He's too short to reach the top of the freezer. But this is the problem, and a lot of franchises are guilty of this, where we have a side character who was popular, so we have to, as inorganically as we can, find a reason to put them in the movie. And even the Lethal Weapon 2, it's flimsy at best, where he's a witness. / he was involved in the money laundering. Okay, I'll go with that because that's the premise of the movie. This one, he is not tied into villain story whatsoever outside of just knowing a warehouse, which they could have found because these two guys are cops. So it's pointless. And despite that rant, I do think the funny Not a lot in this movie that makes me laugh. Him having to disclose everything that happens to this house for the sake of legalities, I do find that amusing.
Funny, because when he's in there, I'm like, oh man, you could tell that he was not originally written in this movie, and he wasn't. Like Matt's point, that makes me laugh, especially because it's completely true is what would have to happen, and he's doing the right thing for these cops. He's not in this much. He's in this actually very little, but holy shit, he doesn't fit. He is shoehorned worse than Rene Russo is into her pumps later on in this film. He just does not belong in this film. You take him out and nothing changes. Nothing at all.
You know what you do with this character? You include him, but you Sergeant Powell him, meaning you give him a phone call or something where he is injected in, but not to the degree that this movie does.
You kill him off.
Well, there's another character I would have killed off later. So Leo walks in on Riggs and Murtaugh, and the couple drives away. We see Roger's son Nick getting dropped off by some friends, and let's get to the bottom of what this movie's about, boys. You know, I mentioned in the beginning that the original script was about neo-Nazis and these neighborhoods getting out of control because of that. Hell, that script also had Riggs being with Rhianne in this, believe it or not, which explains a couple scenes later on. But this movie, without getting into the plot, which we'll get back to here in a bit, this movie was coming out as the Rodney King incident was still on everybody's minds. This movie is essentially about gang and gun violence, but instead of going for the approach of fresh movies like Boys in the Hood and Menace to Society that was coming out around that time, they're telling it in a very farcical way, and that really hurts it.
And this is not New Jack City. And this feels really... I can tell that this was stitched together because the guy that the son is friends with, we have not been introduced to this character in the previous few movies, so it feels tacked on, and I don't think it has the resonance it should when he gets killed later on. I could have done more with this type of stuff and less with the comedy, because I find this to be interesting, and this is actually topical in a way that the apartheid was in the second one, and the first one was all about the fallout and ramifications of how Vietnam left everybody who came back from it. This one's not really about anything. And what it's about feels tacked on and done better by other movies, like the ones you mentioned, and also the stuff of cops turned vigilantes / arms dealers. The second Dirty Harry movie did that 10 times better.
Oh, yeah.
So that even that feels been there, done that.
I think a movie like this, you need to change it. I don't want to see Riggs and Murtaugh doing New Jack City or Colors. I don't want that kind of seriousness in this. I know we did, to your points, the apartheid and the Vietnam PTSD and that kind of stuff, but I think they're trying to play it both ways. I don't think necessarily either one of them go well, but they are trying to address the 300-pound gorilla of gang violence, and it's amazing because they apparently... The costume designer, the only thing they did was watch Public Enemy videos, because every single gangbanger in this is dressed like Eazy-E from that time. Every single one. But at least they're not trying to sit here and say black gang members are bad or black people are bad. And I think if they would have gone that way, that's the way this would have felt. So I'm glad they don't, that it's actually done by a rogue cop or an evil cop. You got to change it up, or I think this would feel so heavy-handed and it'd feel racist with the inability of this movie to write itself well.
Well, this touches on a problem, though, that you sort of referenced in the first movie that would have made for an interesting point of contrasting. You have the son who was raised in, for all intents and purposes, the Cosby Show family, which very wholesome. What happens when they get influenced by stuff that was topical at the time? Juvenile delinquency was on the rise and plenty of other things. So I think that would have given Murtaugh actually something interesting to do as far as an arc, because this one is much more of a Mel Gibson vehicle than it is a Danny Glover vehicle. Like, you're really starting to see the scales become imbalanced. And the stuff that's here for Riggs, or for Murtaugh, excuse me, that we get later on, I have major issues with.
I don't know about that, Matt. I don't know if I agree with that, because Riggs does nothing in this movie. We have him in the beginning cutting the wrong wire, but after that, he is pretty much a witness to everything happening.
But he gets the main love interest. That's his...
That's true.
He gets far more screen time with her one-on-one. Most of the screen time with him is with her, so I think that is why I tip the scales more in his favor.
So Riggs and Murtaugh, they learn the meaning of word as they drive off. We then cut to... Now, I don't really remember next week's villains that well, but this Jack Travis is by far the worst villain of the franchise that we've had. This is an ex-cop building some property. He wants guns to move people toward his ends of town. Yikes. Plus, this whole burying this guy in cement is a terrible rehash of Gary Busey's intro from the first film.
All right, so you know how there's actors who are just born to play villains? You know, your Gary Oldmans, your Michael Wincotts, your Tim Currys, etc. This guy is the opposite of that.
Yes!
Because everything this guy has been in where he's been the main villain, he has no presence and sucks. I mean, look, Ninja Turtles 3 is an awful movie, but he's terrible in it. And I think The Mask of Zorro is a great movie, except for him as the main corrupt government official. I mean, like, this character is very thinly written as it is, but he's not done any favors by casting Stuart Wilson, who just has no, he brings nothing to this role. I mean, this is up there with the worst, most forgettable of the Bond villains. And what is it with these fucking franchises that Richard Donner is associated with that involve real estate and land development?
I thought of that too.
He must have had deep psychological issues about his realtor, because there's this and Leo Getz becomes a real estate agent.
Yep. Yeah, I think the savings and loan scandal that happened just before this was the real villain. Does anybody... Oh, Matt won't. He, kids today. Garrett, do you remember the old Micro Machines commercial?
Yeah.
Super fast about Micro Machines. That's who this dude playing Jack Travis reminds me of. Just the Weasley's... I mean... Oh, God. He's Joe Pesci without the charm. This dude has got... Oh, man. He's forgettable. He's annoying as shit when he's on screen. He's kind of a Weasley little talk out of his nose, kind of. He just... Oh, my God. That mustache is probably painted on. He's such a bad fake cop. Every movie, we're taking steps just down the staircase in the way of our villains. And it's a shame. But this guy is... Yeah, he's utterly forgettable.
Oh, this is falling down an M.C. Escher painting by comparison.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Riggs runs to stop a scene featuring Rianne from being filmed. Rianne respects Riggs for jumping in, thinking that she was in trouble, as she is subsequently fired. Riggs then punches the director in the mouth and reenacts the Three Stooges until Rianne is hired right back.
Like this also makes... I feel like a lot of this movie, and I said this previously, Riggs feels like a complete moron. It's like, okay, because he's no longer suicidal... We just have to make him borderline stupid. He knows she's an actress. This movie should have been scored by Billy Joel, because everything is I go to extremes with how these characters, especially Riggs, act.
For anybody, this is the second time, champion a lot of the first time, that, hey, these houses they go to up in the Hollywood Hills feels like they know what they're talking about. This is what goes on. This is the second time in the opening 40 minutes of this film. One, there's no high-speed chases throughout Los Angeles freeways. No. That doesn't happen. Why? Because you can't fucking speed on Los Angeles freeways, people. Even back in the 90s. Second, you don't shoot out in the open public without it being closed off. The sound alone picking up what's going on. So there's parts of this I'm just like, come on, man. You got somebody that's at least blocking out your perimeter of your set, and to just have this, I don't know. The stupidity is infected everywhere. I think they just found little scenes they liked from all the different versions of this script, and they're fighting to find ways to keep them in. To your point, Matt, Riggs was such a complicated, well-acted character, especially in that first one, and he developed more in the second one. This isn't the same guy. I mean, this guy just acts just aloof to everything. There's no depth anymore. He's wading in the shallow pool.
Yeah, he's in the shallow pool with a helmet on, most likely.
You bring up a good point, Adam. We have left Los Angeles in this movie. Yes, it takes place in Los Angeles, but they are filming in Florida in this, and you can definitely tell if you watch.
It feels like it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And you can tell it's Florida because everyone was probably asleep by 6 p.m.
They go back to the car and see a ticket on the window. Roger sees Riggs eating dog biscuits. And then Roger says that he cut himself shaving, not because of an old razor, but because of an old face. He reminisces about his career as Riggs loses it in the locker room. To go to your point, Matt, boy, is he dumb here.
Not just that, like the dog biscuits, that feels like, and everyone's totally okay with this.
Where it's I
like,
know.
Like nobody calls him out on how disgusting that is.
We go to the gun range as it's revealed that Roger is wearing a girdle. And this is when we also learn about cop killer bullets, which are armor-piercing and are out on the streets.
Better pray that OCP doesn't come into play.
We then see Jack Travis had to talk to Billy Phelps. And by the way, Jack's walking in, signing these papers, by the way, to see this guy right out in the open.
And he, not just that, he fires a gun multiple times. Yes. Walks past the cops.
Yes.
Nobody stops him. Nobody says who you were. He used to be a cop. Nobody recognizes him.
That's my problem. Okay, I get, yes, he knows where the cameras are. So he doesn't just know police stations. He knows this police station. Has everybody there only been there 2 weeks? Nobody knows who this guy is. Nobody recognizes this guy. Period. There's no fucking way.
You know, I can go with an eventual lighter tone. In fact, as a teenager, I did. Adam, when you and I watched this in our marathon, we laughed our fucking asses off when we were teenagers.
Yeah. It's a great one to show a 12 to 15-year-old.
Yes. But you watch this now, and you think about it. The stupidity behind it drives me crazy now. Just as you said, Matt, this guy would get recognized one step in this building, let alone going in an elevator with our two heroes and just walking by everybody and shooting this guy like nothing. It's beyond stupid. And it's shocking to me that we have a 40 draft script here and none of this was caught.
You know what's amazing is that this person is recognized within 2 seconds of seeing him on videotape, yeah, but not within 2 seconds of seeing him face to face.
Yes. So Roger and Riggs, they get in the elevator with our eventual love interest of the film, good old Rene Russo. Now, this character, this began as a man, and he was supposed to be the character who joins the team for about 5 minutes later on in the film, that character of Shane. That was going to be this character. But eventually, Richard Donner changed the script around to include a love interest for Riggs. Adam, I know how you feel about Rene Russo, so I'm not even going to ask you. Matt, how do you feel about Lorne in this, sir?
Thank God for Rene Russo, because for 90% of this movie, she's the only one who feels like a fully realized character. She's taking it seriously. She doesn't take any of Riggs' shit until the plot requires her to fall for him, because it's the one woman rule for these franchises, because there's a woman that they have to fall for the lead who's not married. But I think she's great. I think she brings a good dynamic. I think the 3 in Lethal Weapon 3 is kind of a turnabout phase of including her as like the third weapon. So I think she's good. There's just a couple things that I don't like that they do with her.
Oh, definitely. I'm completely with you, Matt. I think this is a fully realized character. By the way, the character that was mostly focused on by Carrie Fisher in the rewrites, and you can definitely feel that. I'm with you. I like her presence here, but I don't know what she does to Riggs' character. Although, to your guys' point, not like he was that much realized before she came in anyway.
I think she's a good inclusion. I could take more of her and less of Leo. I think she breaks up the boys' team well, and I think by being a character that gives him shit, not just because she's there to give him shit, but because it's her job and she does that job well, to Matt's point, until the magic penis rule comes into effect she doesn't. But yeah, it's a good character and definitely not one that we saw a lot at that time. Even when they have their dress down scene later on, it never gets past a certain point. When she fights in this, she has jeans and a blazer. She's not overly sexualized, and I think that's impressive for this kind of film.
I also like that she's not like Sarah Connor in Terminator 2, where she's a dude with boobs for all intents and purposes.
Yep.
Like, they didn't feel the need to have her bulk up because she's an action star. And look, you compare her to the only other contemporary I can think of around this time. I'm sure there's more, is like Nancy Allen in the RoboCop movies, where it's like, yeah, she's there. But of all the reasons I love RoboCop, she's not really one of them.
Donner wanted Winona for this.
In fact,
they were going to cast her, but she said, no, I'm not going to do action movies, and I'm doing this little thing with Francis Ford Coppola, so you guys do your own thing.
Her and Mel Gibson together.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. That is not a good match. I think they picked the right woman for this role. And this is the movie that pretty much launched her. Yeah, she was doing small things around this time. She had done Major League and a few movies before, but this is the one that kind of made her into a star.
Yeah, because right after this, she did In the Line of Fire. Yep. She did Get Shorty.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she became a big star. She didn't get Batman because they said she was too old, that's the ultimate, like, slap in the face.
Gotta love Hollywood.
She's always looked like a mature woman. Even in this, when this movie's, it's over 30 years ago, but she's always looked kind of this age.
Yeah, even when, we're going to eventually get to Thor, she still looked like this in that movie. It's weird. So Riggs and Murtaugh, they're whispering about her as they exit the elevator, not realizing that she is Lorna Cole from Internal Affairs. By the way, guys, what's up with Mel Gibson's ponytail in this movie?
Okay, if he was a cop, there is a dress code.
Yes.
They would not let him have that ridiculous mullet, especially because right before this, he did Hamlet, where he cut his hair.
Yeah.
And then he grew it back out for this. Maybe he was already thinking of Braveheart.
I was thinking that, too.
But yeah, it looks so bad. That is a relic of the 80s that just I guess they couldn't take that clump off his head back in 1989. It just latched onto him and stuck around.
So they head to the captain and they all learn that the Phelps case was being transferred to Internal Affairs. Cole makes a Mad Magazine crack that offends Riggs, and Captain Murphy reinstates both of them by giving their badges back.
I also hate this in movies where you're demoted for 30 minutes and then the plot...
I hate it too. Say,
apparently cops can turn over badges like James Bond can get his license to kill, revoked, and then reinstated.
Not to mention, for those that don't know, Murtaugh's in a police union. He's got 8 days to go. There is no chance in hell he is anywhere near an office, more or less a street. He is on vacation for 3 months before that retirement date hits. That's how it works.
Riggs and Murtaugh find the body of Billy Phelps, and Roger says that this 6 days are going to be rough.
To be fair, watching this movie feels like it's 6 days.
Lorna puts in a tape of the murder, and they spot Jack Travis, and this is when we get exposition regarding the villain of the film, as, again, he was an ex-cop who wasn't caught as he was walking in the police station.
That's also the only, there's no interesting backstory, just he's an ex-cop.
Well, no, here's the backstory. The backstory is, he was on a stakeout, he left to get coffee, and never came back. Like... That's what we're given.
Literally the dad that goes out for cigarettes and
never comes home. And this is when we get the, as Adam calls it, the real shoehorn of the film, as we learn that Leo recognizes Jack, kind of.
Hey,
as,
I know that guy.
Yeah,
I know that guy.
As he was introduced.
I got the guy.
As he was introduced to him by another guy. God, again, they are just struggling to keep Leo here. Speaking of struggling, we cut to a hockey game.
Like this, I forgot about the scene entirely.
I did too.
And I hate it so much because the 90s was all about trying to bring sports into action movies. Like Last Boy Scout was all about football. Uh-huh. This had to incorporate hockey, which is shameless enough. But the fact that nothing of consequence comes from this scene. There is no vital information that they obtain. There is no other witness that they can go interrogate. They go to this hockey game. Hilarity, in quotes, ensues. And the villain gets away. There's nothing substantial in this 10 minutes. And you could have had Leo get shot and killed, but no, they keep him alive.
I like hockey.
Yeah.
You know, it's awkward. You know who didn't like hockey around this time? Anybody in fucking L.A.
Yes.
So this is just a strange inclusion.
Yeah, that's the other thing, too. This is not Boston or New York, which are good. Or, you know, this is not Canada where they worship hockey, you know, 7 days of the week. It's L.A. Were the Kings even a thing back then?
They were. I remember seeing a lot of King stuff being worn around schools around this time.
I'm talking about L.A. Kings, not Stephen King in your schools.
No, I'm talking about the LA Kings. Yeah, I would see LA Kings shirts. Adam, you can vouch for this around our school all the time.
Yeah, sadly, yeah. I think that's true.
Before the Sharks came into town.
Yeah, well, also more importantly, in this scene, they establish a foolproof way to arrest the villain, and he still gets away.
Yep.
These guys, they have gone from being reckless but still capable to sheerly incompetent in every facet.
Riggs gets on the mic to tell Jack that they're on to him. He makes his way right to Leo, who tries getting the attention of the other two. Riggs goes through the ice as Jack shoots Leo and runs away. Leo thinks the fact that he's cold means that he's dead, and then they chaos. Riggs loses Jack.
This movie needs 2 minutes in the penalty box.
They get Leo to the hospital, and Riggs says that he's going to recommend Leo stay overnight because of, I quote, a dum-dum wound.
This at least makes...
Adam, ridiculous. You are ridiculous.
This is so dumb that I can't help but laugh. This is 12-year-old humor, and I got to remember what I felt like when that was. And I'm sorry, but I've used the DUM rule before. That's like when people ask me at work, what's wrong? I'm like, oh, you made an ID10T error. Oh, spell it out. Write it down. You'll figure it. So yeah, I've told people that they've got a dumb problem. Ugh. But I can't believe just how juvenile this is.
Like it's so crass, they might as well have him get a rectal exam on camera.
Riggs and Murtaugh, they stop off for a burger that apparently they'll let Roger behind the counter to make without washing his hands.
In this movie, there is no such thing as regulations or healthcare.
Yes.
Or any sort of law and order, because even the cops are morons. So maybe this is a prequel to Mad Max where society is about to collapse.
And again, there's absolutely no detecting going on. Each and every bit of progress they make on this case is because of circumstance. For example, it is as Roger is making the best burger in the world, apparently, that Riggs discovers a car of thugs, and he's taken out as Roger is in pursuit amongst porta-potties. He unloads a clip, and we discover that Roger has shot this kid we met for 5 seconds earlier in the film. This is what I'm going to bring up when I brought up earlier. How much more powerful would this have been had he shot his son?
I thought that's what the reveal was going to be.
Yep.
Instead, they take the cheap way out of killing this kid that disposable plot-wise. I mean, yeah, you feel bad for his family or whatever, but plot-wise, this kid's killed, and that's what propels Roger. It would have been so much more powerful had he shot Nick.
Especially because the only way I would buy him being as downtrodden as he is later on is if he accidentally killed his kid. Yes. That would justify it. This, in my mind, does not, because there's not enough context.
I think the one way that they could have done it even stronger is if, not if Murtaugh kills him, but Riggs does. As close as he is with that family, imagine the family trying to make Riggs feel okay at the same time they're mourning their own son being killed. We don't recognize this guy enough. So you both have said we meet him for 10 seconds earlier in the film, and you might as well have had a crow on his shoulder. You know this kid's going to show up dead later on. There's two people you know are going to die in this film, and guess what? They both do. But the coincidences in this film make it feel so stupid. Everybody just walks into something going on or walks around the corner to a drug deal, to an arms deal, to a robbery, to a, hey, I know that guy. Everything is just fucking, my God.
Riggs calls Trish to give her the news as she looks at her kids over her shoulder. I'll say this much. We've been really ripping this film to shreds, and rightly so, but this is a good shot by Donner here of her just kind of on the phone and looking over and looking at her kids and realizing what she's going to have to tell them. I thought this was good stuff.
Yeah, because the movie actually remembered that the family was an integral part.
Yes. Riggs meets up with the police therapist for a few seconds as Lorna is asked to step into Riggs' orifice.
Oof. See, and that's she has a little more to do in the first two, but she completely gets kicked out of the way as soon as they got Rene Russo in this film. I have a feeling that half of what Russo has to do was originally designed for that therapist.
Especially since the Rene Russo character wasn't even written as a woman initially, so you might be onto something, Adam.
She's been in every single one of these, and yep. She's given a little more to do.
So Lorna gets on Riggs about how they withheld information from her. Riggs asks her to let him help on this case as she asks him to wash his hands. Finally, somebody asks somebody to wash their hands here. Lorna isn't too impressed with Riggs' gun as we see her trace the gun, and Lorna says that Riggs busting Billy Phelps really stumbled onto something, which is the plot of one Jack Travis. We didn't get the line that Rene Russo herself ad-libbed, which was, "Close is a lingerie shop without a front window." That was her line. I had to actually stop the film boys and Google this to make sure it was, and yes, it was. It was an actual lingerie shop. They head to the warehouse as Riggs somehow negotiates with a dog, one of the most bizarre scenes I've ever seen in an action film, as Mel Gibson is on all fours acting like a dog eating biscuits in front of it.
Again, they're just, he is one piece of cel-shaded animation away from being a cartoon character. They have brought him to Homer Simpson levels of buffoonery. I need Tommy Lee Jones to come out of nowhere and say, I cannot sanction your buffoonery anymore.
Not for another 3 years, sir.
But you know how we got the Scary Movies and how those were around and what they did to Scream in that frame? I feel like what they're doing here is kind of like a Scary Movie version of the Act Buddy Cop franchise.
It
feels a weapon. Yeah, you're right. It feels like we're spoofing what came before. Mel's got some comedic chops. It's not that he's not doing it well. It just doesn't fit. Don't get me wrong. If she asked me to, I'd get on all fours in front of Rene Russo with a dog biscuit in my mouth. Okay, but that fits my character. It doesn't fit Riggs.
It sure does. Riggs finds where more guns are being shipped as he's attacked and found out. Lorna shows up and fights her way through them before driving off in a pickup. Riggs catches up and jumps into the back. As they escape, the dog just jumps into the back with them.
What happened to his dog in the last film? He still had the dog.
I thought he still had him, yeah. Meanwhile, Tyrone is trying to get out of a deal with Travis, but Travis threatens him until he ends up staying. We cut back to Riggs and Lorna as they reenact the bruise comparing scene from Jaws until they make out for the first time. As I mentioned before, I like the character of Lorna a lot. I just don't like what she does to the character of Riggs, a character I used to like because of his edge, and his edge is completely gone here, and with the exception of getting laid, again, Riggs does nothing this entire film.
His edges have been rubbed off to the point where they're like nubs.
Exactly. We then get the Raspberry of the Decade Award for Worst Scene of the 90s as Riggs gets on Roger's boat and they do just a terribly written and delivered scene between these two. I'm honestly not blaming Gibson as he's trying his best to keep the scene afloat by offsetting Glover's just terrible overacting here.
Because they're on a boat.
Yeah, that was the joke. Yeah, you caught that. I'm happy for you. But this scene in the director's cut is like 4 minutes longer. This is so bad. So bad.
Oh, this has all the histrionics of General Hospital, and it's not just poorly written. I think it's just you're this bent out of shape because you killed one guy that your son is friends with. You've been a cop for this long.
Yeah.
If the film had been going in a dark place when we had earned this, there could be something here. But it's not earned with what this film has done and brought so far, and this isn't the film we've been watching. This thing is so scattershot and is so all over the place. And as I'm watching it, like, I'm not hating, I'm not angry. You could just see the depreciation in what this franchise went to. And I'm not going to say this thing went to the way of Beverly Hills Cop 3, but holy shit, did this take the dive that I wasn't expecting.
As research for this series, I've been going through the TV series that it's based on. I want to get more into it next week when we talk about part 4, but this plot line of him killing this friend is actually done in that series as well, and to preview my thoughts, it's actually done a little better. With the way this movie handles it, we go from him shooting this kid to poor Danny Glover trying his best here, but it doesn't have any real depth to it, and I'm watching these two fight with each other, and I'm feeling nothing. And last week, hell, when there was a possibility of Riggs getting killed, which originally he was, I was feeling for them last week. This time, I'm not. That's the problem.
I feel like this whole movie is Shane Black sitting there drinking a beer going, see, I told you we should have killed him off.
If they flip the script from what the first film was, where this killing, justified, happens much earlier in the film, and Roger is trying to wrestle each day as he's counting down to retirement that this happened, you could have a powerful story.
We see Roger telling Nick to not go against the grain before we cut to the very 90s funeral, complete with Boys to Men playing in the background.
Yeah, End of the Road, I guess, was unavailable. what was that movie? Boomerang, I think, had the list for that.
This is a lot of attention being brought to a character we barely knew.
Yeah, they had to break out the Elm Street checkbook to pay for a funeral scene.
Roger goes to find out where the gun came from and flashes it to Tyrone and his guys. This, of course, sets up a show where Lorna once again fights her way out and Riggs can't stop grinning ear to ear while applauding. We then see Murphy head to his car and taken hostage by Travis, so now we get the captain involved.
I forgot this guy was even a kid.
I did too, actually. Riggs tries showing Roger a backspin kick as the police therapist once again shows up to talk to Riggs. Dolores, the woman from the chase earlier, shows up to deliver a message to Roger, who says that she calls him all the time and he's running out of excuses to tell Trish.
My fucking God, is this unbearable.
It's so bad.
You mean to tell me he wouldn't just tell her, I'm married, call it off?
Yeah.
This movie is all about emasculating the men, but not in the way that modern movies do it, where it just, that's a whole other issue, but this is the template, and you know damn good and well if this movie came out nowadays, they would say Rene Russo was too much of a strong female character.
I'm laughing a little bit, but in that sitcom way. I can laugh as a 12-year-old, 14-year-old mind. I can't laugh as a 40-something guy going, I'm going to go back to it. It doesn't fit. This is a badly shaped puzzle piece.
Riggs and Murtaugh are looking over some of Jack's thugs as Leo shows back up with a sling, telling stories about his rectal exam, and wouldn't you know it, we get a monologue about how they fuck you at the hospital.
Oh my God.
Cringe. Absolute cringe.
You know who the real star of Home Alone was? Me. Joe Pesci. You know who the star of Home Alone 2 is? Me. Joe Pesci. You gotta put me in your Lethal Weapon, or else they're going to fuck you with the Lethal Weapon. They fuck you with the Lethal Weapon. God damn it. How do you do the exact same bit? This isn't Chris Rock doing his new stand-up special where all he did was repeat the shit from Bigger and Blacker 20 years ago. No, it's not the same fucking bit.
Save Chris Rock discourse for next week.
Exactly. But that's what this series has been, boys. That's what I was telling you guys last week. This is the exact same movie, except done in a very farcical way. Now, again, the edge is gone. We don't have any real darkness. We have reenacted bits like this.
This feels like a monologue from My Cousin Vinny.
My Cousin Vinny was more sharply written than this.
No, but like the whole crux of it, because he, you know, there's a lawyer in that, and uh-huh. it sounds like something you'd be saying. It just feels, this stuff feels like bad improv.
Lorna gives more info on where Jack is going as Riggs finds a fanboy who wants to go. And again, this was the character that Rene Russo was supposed to be. The Shane character. They head to the site, which apparently is a subway system located in the basement of a police building. What the hell's going on, guys?
Adam, apparently LA is Gotham City, where there's just fucking a bat cave underneath the police department.
And they don't know it. Yeah. Okay.
They start another gunfight as Murphy moves someone onto the tracks to get electrocuted. Adam, this must have brought back some bad memories.
Oof, man, I've heard these calls at work. This was new.
Of course, the rookie that we met for 5 minutes gets shot, which I guess was the point of this. Riggs goes on a foot race, and the train heads outside and apparently has a mechanism that allows it to go onto the street.
This popped me. This truck was on the rails, this is a vehicle like we have at work. So when they are out inspecting the rails and doing stuff, they have a vehicle that, yes, has got a device that goes on the gauge of the rails that will lift it up from its actual tires, and then you can go back and forth. I can't believe how accurate this was. Like, somebody on the production team saw this and went, we got to figure out a way to get that. No, somebody was just enamored by it.
Matt, they did this scene for an audience of one.
30 years later.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Riggs gets on a motorcycle and chases them down. It's another pretty decent action scene. I like Riggs ducking to avoid the truck trailer, though I could have done without him emerging from smoke in slow motion.
My God, the trailer shot? Yeah.
They saw Arnold do that in Terminator 2 on a motorcycle. They're like, we got to put that in our movie.
He stumbles off the bridge while holding onto a hose, but he eventually falls through some wood panels on the ground. And he even brings back the shoulder trick to get out of this. Remember the shoulder trick from last week, boys?
From every fucking dinner.
Yeah. Leo shows up to compliment the car chase as he listened via the police scanner he acquired.
God, they just... Who gave him a car?
I know.
Who gave him access to the set?
Just because you're an accessory in a previous case does not mean the police have to keep you around.
Yeah, but the fact that he has a gold statue means they are going to keep him around. That's the problem. Riggs shoots out Leo's tires to make sure he doesn't follow them. Meanwhile, Riggs and Murtaugh, they head to the half-built site where they run into Lorna. Trisha's car is once again shot up. You're laughing your ass off.
Okay, no. The station wagon is fair game. Because that poor fucking car has gone through more trauma than Riggs himself. You can beat that car up and it's earned.
Riggs yells about not going on three before asking Roger to cover him. He apparently knows what kind of gas there is by tasting it, and then asks Roger to count to 20 as he drives the car through the development.
This is where Tokyo Drift got it from.
Yeah, I thought of that too.
Except there's no Kid Rock music or whatever fucking band did that. The Kid Rock, I think it was. Instead, we're stuck with Sting, Eric Clapton, and Elton John.
All adrenalizing artists.
Who is it on the production team that went, you know what? I watched Lethal Weapon 2. You know that scene at Murtaugh's house? Let's just do that entire construction scene for a finale. How do you do the same fucking thing and now it's just a development?
And he's like, guess what? We don't have to pay the production department to build a full set.
And they didn't. Looking this up, this was literally, and can you imagine this today, in today's day and age? This was an abandoned, half-built subdivision out where it was, thanks to the savings and loan scandal, and they were able to just destroy this shit.
Well, this is why Silver was as successful as he was, is because he was able to find stuff like this and build an action scene around it. The problem is, you build an action scene around it, but you don't build a plot around it. You know?
Yeah, that's that. The nose candy.
Well, that too. Yeah.
over. It's what he did at the, we talked about at the beginning of this film. That building was going to be demolished already. Let's put it in a film.
Roger wonders when somebody is going to cover him before losing count and just shooting the gas that Riggs laid out for him. Riggs outruns the fire before it catches up to him and sets off the ammo in the car. Meanwhile, Lorna is making her way through the development before Riggs throws some gas on a thug. This doesn't stop Lorna from being shot, though, and Riggs once again opens up his crazy side and goes after Travis. Travis gets rid of him before getting behind the wheel of a tractor, and this was one of the only things I remembered going into this viewing, that the main bad guy is shot by cop killers through the tractor. I'm sorry, ex-cop killers. Oh boy.
I'm glad he's gone, because he was just so underwhelming. I remembered this ending. Some of the stuck around, like I knew what was coming. I remembered it very vividly. And what was once cool 30 years ago just really doesn't live up. This entire final action scene is just... I can't say any of the final action scenes have been good in these ones, except maybe the first film, but this one is just a very lazy way to finish off this film.
Well, it feels as unfinished and hollow as these housing developments.
Yeah. The whole development comes down as Riggs holds Lorna for a nice romantic night by the fire. We cut to Roger's house as he's once again in the bath, and once again his family is inside to celebrate. But Murtaugh says that he can't retire, and he has to stay on the force.
So the whole movie was pointless.
You just summed up my summarization.
Everything he wrestled with, all of his inner dilemma for him just to say, eh, fuck it. Like three movies of development just down the shitter.
I know many between my family, grandfather, uncles, many, many friends of the family who retired in law enforcement. If the day that your wife came to you to celebrate retirement, you told her that day you were staying on for another several years, you'd have divorce papers that night.
God, I thought of the same exact thing.
You just fucked your family pretty bad.
Yeah, that's something I did not think about when I watched this with you, Adam, as a teenager. But now I watch it, I'm like, oh God, if I came home after building up for a few years that I was going to, you know, this is going to be my last year, my future wife would then become my ex-wife.
Your house got blown up.
Yeah.
Your boat got destroyed. You've been shot at.
I'm staying with just that.
Our oldest kid was held hostage. We were attacked in our bed. Like, she must have amnesia and has forgotten all the horrible shit that's happened.
Like every character in this. His family says that they're behind him all the way. And Roger says word to Nick. Leo makes his way in and says that he sold the house, but Roger says the house is indeed off the market. Leo says that he and Riggs owe him four new tires, and he's then kicked out of the bathroom by Trish, who just utters, "You're friends." We get more banter about Riggs not being able to kick his dog biscuit problem until he started smoking, and Riggs says that he and Lorna are serious, as they have a dog together now. So Roger doesn't need to worry about him going after Rianne. As more calls come through, and credits roll, finally, on Lethal Weapon 3.
All the other movies we felt just ended so abruptly, and I guess they listened to us in the past somehow, and they were like, hey, we're going to let them have a little bit of banter towards the end of the film. Yeah, we were wrong.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't help.
Yeah, I mean, this might as well have ended with a curtain call.
All right. Scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Lethal Weapon 3? Adam?
I feel like we beat up this movie about as much as Lorna beats up the thugs throughout this film. For good reason. You had a very smart kind of genre-defying film with Lethal Weapon. And you had a sequel, came down with a case of the sequelitis with Lethal Weapon 2. But both of those still had a level of intelligence and smartness to them, wittiness, and something to say. This doesn't have anything to say other than sequels make money and Joel Silver needs more cocaine. And it seems like that's what this did. Mel Gibson is full Mel Gibson at this point. I don't see Martin Riggs in Mel Gibson, and I think that's pretty sad. Same thing with Danny Glover. I like the addition of Renee Russo, not just because she was an early crush. Fucking redheads, man, they'll get you. But I think she's not your stereotypical woman that you get in this kind of film, and I was glad to see her at the same time. Then we get Joe Pesci coming back, and everything that he's in is annoying as fuck throughout this film. This thing is just, it's lazy writing. It's got the most convenient ways of sticking one scene to another. Horrible sinew connecting tissues that really shouldn't be connected. I understand they just needed to put something on screen. They did. While I'm watching it, I can enjoy it with friends. I could have a beer, have a burger with you guys, sit down, watch this, and we could laugh our way through it. When I'm watching it going, is this a good movie? It's not very good. It can be entertaining at parts. It's such a giant step down from the second one, and especially the first one, that it's kind of insulting. I'm going to give it a 6. You know, I don't not like this movie, but it's really stunning going back now to watch it and go, fuck, this is such a step down. Because at one time I thought this is what sequels could be, and now I'm like, oh boy, this is what sequels come to.
All right, a 6 from Mr. Bunch. Matt, what about you?
Wow, that's more generous than I'm going to be. Boy, this is the... We're starting to see the law of diminishing returns already, and we're on the third movie, which has me dreading next week's show. You know, even divorcing myself as best as I can from my sheer admiration for Shane Black as a screenwriter, the disparity in quality between the writing of this movie compared to the previous two is pretty startling. You can attribute that to whatever you want. The 47 rewrites, 2 writers on this, Lord knows how many other hands it went through. But at the end of the day, I got to judge the finished product that I saw on screen. And what I saw was very, I'm going to say, studio driven, because there's no real interesting meat on this bone to chew on. It's wafer thin from its plotting. It's got a suck-ass villain, which I think is a huge component of any action movie. And when you have a bad one, not bad in that sense, one that's forgettable, boring, no presence, not memorable whatsoever, that's a huge knock against the movie. And when I look at my 2 lead characters that I liked a lot in those first 2 movies, and seeing what they're kind of regressed to in this one, it's very disheartening. I would have loved to have watched Shane Black's reaction. I think he would have looked like Homelander in that GIF from The Boys, just staring and feeling like he was watching his creation burn on screen. Look, this is not one of the worst things I've ever seen, because, hello, we just did Children of the Corn parts 1 through 11, and I think there are worse installments in other action franchises, but I think when we talk about, like, where does it all go wrong, this is one to point to, because it's got a lot of the cardinal sins of why these things kind of go off the rails. So I'm going to go one step higher than the numerical integer with this movie. I'm giving this a 4 on 10.
Oh, boy. This was around the time when I was starting to pay attention to reviews in the newspaper that we get, Adam, the Contra Costa Times. And I remember opening the review to that and it giving it like a C- or D+ or something. And when I eventually watched the film, I'm like, why are critics so much harsher on this? I thought it was great. As I said, like, I let all these plot holes go right past me as I watched this, and eventually watched it with Adam before next week's film, and loved every minute of it. I watch it now, and my God, it is hard to not see. And I was a big critic of Shane Black's script. I was not a huge fan of it, but his non-presence is definitely felt here. Look, I think they tried their best. I see Jeffrey Boehm coming in. I see Robert Mark Kamen coming in and doing what they can with these characters that Shane Black had pretty much dispensed of once he was done with Lethal Weapon 2. The effort they put into it was in the wrong direction. They went with farce instead of going for a more deeper meaning. Again, at a time when L.A. was at a very big state of unrest, you could have definitely done something with the environment that that place was in at the time this was being released, but they didn't. We get this terrible character during this chase. We get terrible plot holes involving a really bad action villain. This villain, we've beat him to death, but it deserves as much as we've given him, because he is just bad. Hell, even compared to last week's villains, who I wasn't a big fan of. This is a pretty bad movie now that I watch it, but there is some good action done here. I think the stunts are pretty well done. I've always been a fan of the late 80s, 90s action setup, and I think the setups they do here and the payoffs they do in the setups are great. But yet, this is not a good movie. So on that scale, I'm teetering here. I want to go 5. I think there's enough action for those craving that sort of thing. Just don't look for logic. Don't look for NYPD Blue type of plotting. Look for really bad Three Stooges plotting, and that's what you get. If we have low scores this week, boy, I am just trying to imagine what next week's scores are going to look like, because my memories of next week's film aren't very good. Adam, what do you expect when we review Lethal Weapon 4 next week?
I think this is going to be a reality check for me again, watching this movie now, what, 25 years after this one came out. I think we're going to sound like Leo Getz and feeling how he does at the drive-thru in hospital when we come back to Lethal Weapon next week for part four. But I remember back then being really excited about Jet Li, and I was happy for a fourth one. But I don't think that time's going to make this one age well. I think this is going to be rough.
Yeah, you and I would get those premiere magazines, and they were talking Jet Li up, and we were really excited for this leading up to it. Mm-hmm. Really, really excited. Matt, what are you expecting next week?
I have no clue which direction I'm going to lean, because I've only seen Lethal Weapon 4 one time, and it's been at least a decade. So I'm staying positive, because, look, I'm the harshest on this one out of all of us, and while I'm not expecting it to be substantially better, I'm hopeful that I may find more things to look for as bright spots go in the next one, but maybe that's just the optimist in me talking.
That'll be next week. Also next week, we're going to reveal another long-form retrospective that we are going to be launching right after this one's over. Stay tuned for that. People have been craving what we're going to announce next week. Boys, thank you for joining me for a little bit of a rough go with Lethal Weapon 3, but I had a fun time discussing it with you guys, and until next week, when we get to Lethal Weapon 4, I'm too old for this podcast. Thank you, boys.
Yo, you sure are a crazy son of a bitch.
You think I'm crazy?
Yeah.
Are you calling me crazy? You think I'm crazy? Yeah. Yeah, you want to see crazy? I'll tell you.
Now that's a real badge. I'm a real cop, and this is a real fucking gun.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Have a nice day.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Now I can read you guys your rights, but nah, you guys already know what your rights are, don't you?
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Hey, you said you liked it? That's a fair price.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
Aren't you going to miss all this good stuff when you retire? Aren't you going to miss it a little bit?
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including Star Wars, the Mad Max movies, Avatar, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, Jurassic Park, Top Gun, and so many more.
Read 'em and weep. We're partners. We are partners.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Oops.
Right, oops.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
God damn it, you were right, you know. Yeah, there wasn't enough room.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You ever met anybody you didn't kill?
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental. This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
I'm Sergeant Murtaugh. This is Sergeant Riggs.
How do you do? Nice to meet you. Okay, so what do I call you guys?
Sergeant Murtaugh, Sergeant Riggs.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
I'm going to be with you, Warner. Hey, I'm with you now. Look, I'm right here. We're both here, right? Right. Come on, I want to be with you. What do you got to lose?
Let's do what one shepherd said to the other shepherd.
For what?
Let's get the flock out of here.
The first week it was on video, I was there. I brought it home the first week it was at Blockbuster Video, so wasn't one that I really went out of my way to see. Matt, anything to add before I get into this plot?
Question for the jury, what's Blockbuster?
The precursor to Hollywood Video.
Yeah, there you go.
Wait, what's Hollywood? Okay, hang on.
Hey, they started my career.
If your streamer had to mail you, no, didn't even mail, damn it, old Netflix.
No. Yep. Didn't do that.
No, Blockbuster had mailing services.
Well, eventually.
Yeah, they did it one time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shit, they almost bought Netflix and said no.
They said no.
Saying no is what some of the people should have said during the development of this movie.
All right, let's get to that. So we start off. They argue over whether to wait for the bomb squad to take care of it or to do it themselves. And this is where we hear Murtaugh say that he has 8 weeks until retirement.
Days.
What's that?
8 days.
Eight days. 8 days, I'm sorry. This is where we hear that Murtaugh has...
Well, I mean, Twister's almost as bad as Speed 2.
That's what I'm saying.
I don't understand why people love that movie as much as they do.
I don't know.
And the Haunting is like probably one of my like 10 most hated movies ever that's ever been made.
We're doing Twister.
I'm not watching any movies with Helen Hunt, excuse me.
Oh, somebody has a real hatred. Wow. Wow.
Now I'm mad about you.
So Riggs and Murtaugh, they
see, all done.